Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Wyndham Hotels and Resorts makes travel possible for all. Whether it's the long haulers looking for a great cup of coffee, a roomier rest for the on a whim road trippers, or a place to make summer memories with the whole family. No matter who you are, where you're going, or why, with 24 trusted brands to choose from like La Quinta, Days Inn, and Super 8, your Wyndham is waiting. Get the lowest price at WyndhamHotels.com. Restrictions apply. Visit website for more details.
Out front next, Pecker in the hot seat, and a man who covered him for years is my guest. Why he says Pecker will not hold back tomorrow. This is Trump dares the judge to put him in jail. Plus, pro-Palestinian protests grow across the United States. I was on the campus of Columbia University today. I spoke with the embattled Speaker of the House who was there. His message to the president of Columbia University as his job is on the line. And move over, Moscow Marjorie, because Russia has a new favorite Republican, and we will unveil it for you tonight. Let's go out front. And good evening, I'm Erin Burnett. Out front tonight, not holding back. The man who covered David Pecker's every move, his boss of the National Enquirer, tells Out Front that Pecker is going to tell all tomorrow when he's back on the stand. Keith Kelly, who covered Pecker for decades for the New York Post, says Pecker will not be holding back. He's my guest tonight and has a whole lot more to say about Pecker's testimony. And that testimony is going to include all the details about the hush money payment to Stormy Daniels. Pecker will be asked about it in detail when he's back in court tomorrow morning. And remember, Pecker was the one who helped broker the deal between Michael Cohen, Trump's fixer and former attorney, and Stormy Daniels. And this whole deal was about keeping Daniels quiet about an alleged affair with Trump. Here is the secret audio tape between Michael Cohen and Trump himself.
I need to open up a company for the transfer of all of that info regarding our friend David, you know, so that I'm going to do that right away. I've actually come up and I've spoken to Alan Weisselberg about how to set the whole thing up with funding.
I mean, Trump on tape. So what do we got to pay for this? $150? And our friend David that they're referring to is David Pecker. And tomorrow that friend, because now I put that in quotes, apparently they're not speaking, will be just feet away from Trump, speaking about Daniels and all of these details. Meanwhile, Daniels' close friend told us exclusively that Daniels is scared. She said that the threats have been increasing and getting scarier just since the trial began, she told me. So just in these past few days. But she told me that Stormy Daniels is ready to testify if called. Bryn Gingras begins our coverage out front live here in New York. And Bryn, what more are you learning about what we can expect here in just hours when court is back in session?
Yeah, Erin, listen, you hit it right on the head there. We're talking about David Pecker, a man that has been friends with Donald Trump since the 80s, sitting right across from him in the witness stand, just feet away from the former president, as he stares him down, giving these dirty details about this catch and kill scheme in full detail. That is what we are expecting more of tomorrow. And that all started, of course, as we've learned from the testimony in August 2015, when they made that deal between Trump, Michael Cohen, and David Pecker about being the eyes and the ears of the campaign and how they were going to find the stories that were negative about Trump or salacious about Trump, bury them, and promote stories that were positive ahead of that campaign. They went into detail about that Trump Tower doorman who had a story about a woman who claimed that he fathered a child of hers. And then before court wrapped up and David Pecker was done for the day, they got into the details about another Playboy playmate, Karen McDougal, who, of course, alleged an affair with Donald Trump, going to the National Enquirer with her story in June of 2016 and really worrying Trump, according to Pecker's testimony, so much so that Michael Cohen was badgering him for more information about exactly what Karen McDougal had on Donald Trump. So that's where it left off, a very tense moment in the testimony by the prosecution. That is where we are going to pick up and then likely, very likely, get into those details that you just talked about with what happened with the Stormy Daniels incident. Now, it's very important to put this all into context, right? David Pecker is a huge witness for this prosecution because, again, Trump is has 34 charges of falsifying business records, right? That's a misdemeanor. They need to connect the dots for jurors as to why this is a felony, to cover up another crime. David Pecker is one of those witnesses. He's also going to help corroborate another major witness, of course, Michael Cohen. So there's a lot to get to when court resumes tomorrow. In addition to that, we're still, of course, waiting to hear how the judge is going to rule on that gag order. We still don't know if that ruling is going to come tomorrow or when, but certainly a lot of details there that we're waiting for, Aaron.
All right, Bryn, absolutely. And of course, that ruling could come at any time. And our experts are all here with me. Keith Kelly, so no reporter covered David Pecker longer than you have covered him, former New York Post media columnist. So you know this and you know him. He is set to take the stand again tomorrow, and he's been granted immunity in exchange for this testimony, right? It wasn't that he wanted to be here necessarily, but he's gotten immunity. And you think that he won't hold back?
No, I think he will hold. He will not hold back at all. He has nothing to lose now. His immunity deal is basically he has to testify and tell the truth. If he doesn't tell the truth, the deal's off. So he's under the gun, and is probably smiling inwardly that he is not in the same seat that Donald Trump is in or that Michael Cohen is in. His testimony, he turned rat on then Michael Cohen, and that's why Michael Cohen went to jail. So it could have been just as easily them sweating Pecker, and he could have gone to jail.
So and yeah, so everything will come out.
I think everything. He has nothing to hold back. He's probably relieved that he can actually honestly tell the truth.
So, Jeremy, you know, you've been inside and in the courtroom, right? So you've seen Trump as Pecker, you know, started the start testimony. We've seen a bit of. You've seen Trump watching Pecker, Pecker watching Trump, each of them watching the other one watch. I mean, you're really getting the dynamics and the body language here. So what is your sense about how they feel about each other? Guys have known each other for decades, were friends.
Yeah.
In as much of the sense of the word as probably either one of them have friends, and now far from it.
You know, there was really only one light moment in court on Tuesday, and that was when the prosecutor, Josh Steinglass, he asked David Pecker to basically identify Donald Trump. Who is Donald Trump in the courtroom? Can you point at what is he wearing? And he pointed to Trump, and he said, he's wearing a blue suit. And that was the only time where we saw the former president, he stood up, he sat up in his chair, and he gave a smirk. Literally the only smile I saw him flash the entire day of that
testimony. Which you would describe as a smirk.
I'd say it was a smirk. It was, you know, one of the faces he likes to give. Trump was paying attention, I think especially when David Pecker took the stand on Monday. Trump was very focused on his testimony. I think on Tuesday, as it settled in and we listened to him, you know, speak for hours, Trump sort of dialed back, he leaned back in his chair, he shuffled through his papers, and I think he was a little less focused on every word that he was saying.
Well, it's going to be, I mean, tomorrow's going to be a crucial day. So what more do prosecutors need from David Pecker right now, Ryan?
So he's done a tremendous job for them, the opening presentation, and already in some sense corroborating what Michael Cohen will say down the line. But I think there are a couple other pieces of evidence that we know are probably coming. David Pecker knows from a December conversation directly with Donald Trump and Michael Cohen what the financial arrangement was, because Michael Cohen wasn't being paid at the time and asked Pecker to intervene and prevail upon the president-elect at the time to pay him. So he knows about that conversation. And then there's a big one. Summer 2017, the president of the United States invites David Pecker to the White House to thank him for helping him on the campaign. That's an important nexus because the entire theory of the case is that all of this hush money payment schemes were related to trying to win the election. And there's the president Trump.
The meeting to thank him for successfully doing what he is alleged to have done.
Yeah.
Nothing like a meeting where you thank somebody for doing something they're supposed to have done. So Joey, okay, now you are looking at this from the defense side of things. Given all of that, then Pecker is going to go under cross-examination by Trump's team. So what are they going to do?
They have to do a lot, Aaron, and here's why. He gives them, Pecker does, the conspiracy and the cover-up. That's the theory of the case, speaking about the issues of the meeting and what was arranged at the meeting, and so you got to go after him. The first thing you're going to do is to start with this non-prosecution agreement. So you're here, sir, because you have a deal. Is that correct? And that deal means that you're not going to be prosecuted, and you're saying to tell the truth. Whose truth is that? Objection. But here's the reality. The reality is that you have to hit him hard. He gave you, and let's start here. He talks about how Trump is so meticulous, how he monitors everything. What does that mean? It means that the defense saying he didn't know anything about ledgers. He didn't know anything about invoices, right? Through Pecker, it shows he knows everything. You aren't in those meetings. You don't know how he runs his organization. You don't know what he does with those ledgers. You have to get him away from having knowledge of the organization. In addition to that, you aren't in meetings with Michael Cohen and Mr. Trump. You don't know what Trump said to him, if anything, that is Michael Cohen, with respect to conversations with you, whether he was acting under loyalty, fealty, et cetera. You have to go at him a bit. They may have been friends before, but not I'm now. Not so sure they need to be friends now.
I'm just looking here at our quote when Trump and Cohen, and they're talking about it, and Trump says to Cohen, so what do we got to pay for this, $150? I mean, you know, there is the reality that you have. Lordy, I hope there are tapes, Jim Comey. Okay, so Keith, Jerry George worked for the National Enquirer for nearly 30 years as the LA bureau chief. He came on this show a few years ago. He has since passed away. But I want to play something he told us. This is about Trump and Pecker and their relationship. And he told us this all the way back in 2018. Here he is.
David Pecker knows where the bodies are buried. David Pecker knows all of the Trump stories that were killed, all the story leads. He pretty much, you know, knows the worst of President Trump's personal life.
The implication there being that what the American public knows is not anywhere near the worst. And the context here, Keith, if your name is Michael Cohen or Stormy Daniels, Trump's gone after you aggressively.
He hasn't done anything about
David Pecker.
It's very curious that he has not attacked him. And my theory is that he knows that Pecker knows a lot more than he's disclosed. Right now, he's disclosing financial transactions, which he thinks he can explain away, but there's probably a lot more. And that's got to be the only reason Trump would not attack him.
Because he's scared.
He doesn't want to stir him up any further than he is. He thinks as long as he sticks to the basic numbers facts, his lawyers can kind of dissuade, hopefully, in Trump's view, the jury. But if he starts going in with much more salacious stuff, which he may know and Trump will know he knows, that could be a lot worse picture for Trump. It will put him as an even more unsavory character if he knows what he fears he knows.
And that could come out. I mean, that would certainly change the whole tenor of the situation. Jeremy, interesting, Trump hasn't gone after David Pecker. Yeah. As part of this process, been critical of a juror or two, but the jurors in that room right now, he has not been. What is his demeanor like when the jury's in the room?
You know, it really is, I think, different from what we've seen in past cases and even during some portions of this case. And one of the things I'm going to watch for tomorrow is we could get the judge's decision saying that he has violated that gag order. We don't know for sure. The judge didn't give a timeline, but that could be what we get first thing in the morning. And it will be very interesting to see if Trump is as stoic as he was during that hearing, as his lawyer was getting attacked with some very difficult questions from the judge. And that if that does come in the morning, that's going to set the day where we then go straight from him presumably losing on the gag order to then going into testimony about Karen McDougal and Stormy Daniels. And I think to this point, the first 2 days of this trial, he has not really reacted to when the jury is there. We'll see if that changes as the trial moves forward.
Is there a risk for Trump that David Pecker does in any of these questionings come out and reveal new information about Trump's personal life that would be very damaging?
I think it's more that David Pecker could reveal that to the public. And Trump is running a presidential campaign. I think he would have had to probably told the prosecutors at this point everything he knows. For them to now come out with new information, I don't see that happening in the trial context. But he might know so much information about Trump's life over multiple years that it's not necessarily related to this particular scheme or the 2016 election, but much more broadly.
But that would be objectionable, right? Obviously, if new things start to be revealed that are damaging to Trump, that are not on point or relevant to the case, the defense is going to jump out of their chair for that.
Right.
And so, but I do think you have to keep, it really is interesting how Trump attacks everybody else, but Pecker is sort of not to this point been assailed. If his testimony gets any more damaging than it is, because he lays the entire foundation of the case, maybe that'll change too.
All right. Well, thank you very much. In these hours before court goes back into session, we do have some more breaking news here. We have just learned that an Arizona grand jury has just indicted more than a dozen of Trump's allies who are accused of trying to overturn the election in Arizona. This is a significant development, and we have the breaking details on this. We're going to have that for you just as this is coming in after this break. Plus, pro-Palestinian protests growing across the United States on college campuses. Students have been clashing with police on several today. I was at the campus of Columbia University, and I was there with the Speaker of the House, Mike Johnson, who came to New York with a very specific message tonight. And the Nikki Haley factor. So Trump's got a hold on the GOP nomination, right? She's been off the ballot for what? I mean, months. But guess what? She just got a brutal reminder of his challenges heading into the election thanks to a Nikki Haley performance.
This podcast is supported by Sleep Number. Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores? Sleep Number does that. Only Sleep Number smart beds let you each choose your ideal comfort and support. Your Sleep Number setting. Sleep Number smart beds learn how you sleep and provide personalized insights to help you sleep better. All Sleep Number smart beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. Temperature balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
I'm Dr. Sanjay Gupta, CNN's chief medical correspondent. This week on Chasing Life...
Lately, we have been paying attention to a very different virus, bird flu, which is caused by the H5N1 virus. If you start to hear that it's circulating in pigs, that would be a concern.
That means I would go from sleeping with one eye open to one and a half eyes open. Yeah, that would make me very concerned.
Listen to Chasing Life, wherever you get your podcasts.
And we have breaking news. Arizona's attorney general has just announced multiple charges in connection to the 2020 fake elector scheme to try to help Donald Trump overturn the election in the crucial state of Arizona, which was, of course, won by just over 10,000 votes. Among those charged, the 11 alleged fake electors for Trump. And here's the full indictment. There's others that we know here as they are serving these individuals. Some of these names are redacted, but we can figure out who some of them are. Several others also indicted. They are, as I said, some of these names are going to be redacted until they have been served. But we can tell you, because we are learning, that Rudy Giuliani, Mark Meadows are among them, as well as other crucial names in the inner circle of Trump. So let's go straight to Zachary Cohn outside the Maricopa County Superior Courthouse breaking this. So, Zach, just going through this, I'm just going through the number of pages here, 58 pages. You've been able to go through this here literally as this is breaking. What else can you tell us about who is being charged and with what?
Yeah, Aaron, like you said, look, the 11 fake electors from Arizona, the Trump fake electors, they were all indicted. That includes Kelly Ward, who is the former head of the Republican Party here in Arizona, along with her husband, Michael Ward. But more importantly, these names that are redacted, we're learning more about who those people are. They include, as you mentioned, Rudy Giuliani, the former personal attorney of Donald Trump. It includes former chief of staff Mark Meadows, and it includes Boris Epstein, who is still a very close advisor to Donald Trump. And in fact, sources have told us, and people close to Trump have told us, that the reason Boris Epstein hasn't been seen with Trump in New York for the start of his criminal trial there is because of concerns of this looming indictment. So that coming to fruition today.
And so some of these defendants and some of these that you're naming, Boris, obviously, Rudy Giuliani, Mark Meadows, their names are redacted in the version that we have now because I understand they're still actually in the process of serving them. So when I say this is breaking, it's breaking to that level. Is there anything else you can tell us about some of these redacted names, which, by the way, are written, some of them in the context of unindicted co-conspirator number one was unwilling to accept that he lost the election, right? That unindicted co-conspirator number one, obviously, then is Donald J. Trump.
Right, absolutely. And look, these are all individuals from the Trump world, from the Trump universe. The three we've identified so far are obviously very close to Trump or were very close to Trump at a certain time, especially when he was trying to overturn the 2020 election. And we'll learn more about these other redacted names probably about in the next few minutes here. But we are told that they're all from that inner circle, from those people that were working in Trump's orbit to help him overturn the 2020 election. And look, this investigation here in Arizona, it's obviously coming years after those efforts were first exposed. But we always thought that it was really focused on the fake electors themselves. Myself and Marshall Cohen have reported, though, in the last few months that the probe did seem to be expanding and did seem to be looking into people who were connected to the Trump campaign on a national level. And now we know that some of these names in this indictment are in that really that inner circle of Trump's orbit. So we'll bring you more when we have it. But for now, we do know that some of these really close advisors to Donald Trump are included in this indictment.
Zach, thank you very much. All right. So as you get more and you go through this, please, we're going to bring you back into this conversation because, as I said, this is a 58-page document. We're having a chance here to go through it as we speak. So Zach will continue with that. Ryan Goodman, Joey Jackson are back with me. And we're also now joined by former Trump White House lawyer Ty Cobb here with us in New York. All right. So I know we're all just getting a chance to look through this here. Ryan, I'm just going through quickly. 9 felony counts. But can we just hone in here on this, obviously, the fake electors in the state of Arizona charged. Can we just hone in on this inner circle of Trump? Page 20, I'm just going to hold it up for everyone to see. All these black marks are redacted names, but some of these names include Mark Meadows, Rudy Giuliani, Boris Epstein, and what else can you tell?
So I think what's incredible here is that Donald Trump is unindicted co-conspirator number one, unindicted, yet his two alter egos, Mark Meadows, who is his chief of staff, and Rudy Giuliani, his personal attorney, are indicted. So how is it explicable that that Donald Trump is not indicted? I think that's the key question. Just to take a page from the federal indictment, which identifies Rudy Giuliani running with Donald Trump in Arizona to overturn the popular vote, the federal indictment says Giuliani and Trump, quote, made knowingly false claims of election fraud aimed at interfering with the ascertainment and voting by Arizona's electors, end quote, when they're on the call with Rusty Bowers, the Republican head of the Arizona legislature. Rudy Giuliani as a co-conspirator of Donald Trump. But here in the Arizona indictment, Donald Trump is left out. That's a huge question.
Ty, what do you make of that? I mean, it is very clear here, page 21, unindicted co-conspirator number one.
Right.
Can I just read the description here? A former president of the United States who spread false claims of election fraud following the 2020 election. There's a Jeopardy question.
Right.
Sorry.
Who is?
Who is unindicted co-conspirator number one? What do you make of that?
So I think the distinction having not had sufficient time to be certain of this, but I think the distinction may be people who actually acted in Arizona. I think as I review it, it appears that, you know, Giuliani was active in organizing the fake electors, worked with Kelly Ward. I think the same thing is true of the other people who were indicted in conversations, Meadows and Giuliani and Trump. So Eastman is unindicted co-conspirator number 4, as that seems.
Yeah,
there are
5 unindicted co-conspirators. So you're saying 4, you think, is clearly Eastman.
I think 4 is clearly Eastman.
Mm-hmm.
And but those are people who didn't, you know, conduct the elector scheme on the ground or, you know, organize it in a way actively in Arizona. They were people who were, above that fray. Giuliani was there actually. Taking action. Same thing with Meadows in terms of coordination. So I think that's the distinction.
All right. So, Joey, I'm just going through this 9 felony counts, as I said. And this is just to give the summary. Conspiracy, fraudulent schemes, forgery,
problematic. Let me be prosecuted before I'm defense, right?
Yep.
Now, the issue from the prosecution's perspective and people at home are saying, look, whether you acted on the ground or not, if you were a mastermind of an enterprise, it doesn't matter where you are. The issue is, to what extent were you involved? To what extent did you aid, abet, or do any activity that might further the interest of forgery, et cetera, as you say.
Yep.
And so I think people are wondering, well, why isn't everyone accountable? Prosecutors have a great deal of discretion, right? And so prosecutors are going to do what they feel is in the best interest to secure the indictment they secure. But it's a fair question as to why these unindicted people are not actually indicted. Now, from a defense perspective, you know, Aaron, and you have to get into the realm of politics, even in law, because it's become so political. You know what Trump's going to say. Who is the attorney general, Democrat or Republican? Democrat, why did it take so long to do this? She's going to say, because I came after a person who was in office for two terms who did nothing. But you can look to this to be attacked on political grounds as the basis for which it's moving forward. I guarantee you that's what all the news reports are going to be. It was because of this Democratic attorney general. It lacks evidence. It lacks information, et cetera. The proof will be in the specific details of an indictment.
And I know we're literally trying to, as we're talking, sort of skim through this. But what I'm noticing already, Ryan, just going through it here, that there are a lot of text messages and other corroborating data, just even going through this
in terms
of some of the allegations. Yes, what one would call proof.
Absolutely. And some of it actually spilled out into the New York Times earlier. So they actually had a lot of the written communications in which some of the Arizona players referred to the alternative electors as fake electors. And then they said to each other, maybe that's not the best term that we should use for it. They were also going to try to hide the information about the false electors until January 6th and then spring it on Congress, which is not the way you go about submitting your elector slate to Congress if it was a legitimate operation. So that internal documentation is damning when now we're getting into a prosecution setting. And I think that's going to be very important. It actually does set aside Arizona as different than other states because I think the evidence is just much stronger here for the prosecutors.
I mean, it is very, very laid out. So, Ty, when you go through 9 felony counts,
yes,
being the allegations, can you just lay out the significance of that? What does that mean in terms of what these people who are being charged, what would the repercussions of conviction be?
So the repercussions of conviction, I think, are very serious. I think that it's highly likely that, jail time is on the table for some of these people. I think particularly those who, were at the head of the table in terms of organizing this and getting the scheme off, could be subjected to jail time. I do think the 9 counts, actually, as a former prosecutor, I view that as good prosecuting. I mean, I think, you see these 34 count indictments like we have, and,
you're saying you see 9 as narrow.
Yeah, I see 9 as, focused. I mean, keep in mind, this is a 14-month investigation. And the Arizona Attorney General, who is going to get criticized for this, of course, but she's a serious lawyer. As far as I can tell, having gone through this, looks pretty well organized. And, the proof will be in the actual trial. But, the way the indictment is laid out, it's carefully crafted and seems to be a very serious document.
And Aaron, in terms of Ty's point, which is a very good one, of course, as it relates to what prosecutors do, they charge these multiple indictments, right? And the issue with that is anyone will do. If you get one conviction as it relates to a multiple indicted case, you're a winner. And the offense, it really depends upon what you've been convicted of. But some of these sentences, right, are quite significant. And so when you have a multi-count indictment, it really enhances the exposure of the individuals who were indicted.
All right, so now let's just talk about, I guess, first take a step back, unindicted co-conspirator number one, Donald J. Trump, former president of the United States. What happens when you get a conviction to unindicted co-conspirator number one? I mean, that is legally nothing?
Legally nothing. Nothing.
And the only other point to maybe make here is just to remind everybody, this is a state prosecution of state crimes. If Donald Trump is elected president, he can't do anything about it. He can't pardon these people because that's only about federal crimes. He can't quash the investigation because that's only about the Justice Department, not about state law enforcement authorities. So he's just left out there as unindicted co-conspirator, and then these folks might be left holding the bag.
I would say there's an interesting nuance point here, too, because you hit the forgery. Keep in mind that in the 1512C discussion before the Supreme Court, the issue is, evidentiary interference as opposed to just any obstruction. You know, so the forgeries actually highlight the strength of Jack Smith's case because, you know, that is evidence. You know, those forgeries are evidence. And interference or obstruction in that manner is will be actionable no matter what the Supreme Court decides.
All right. So there's also the, I guess, let's just compare this now, because when you bring up that Trump would be unable to pardon, et cetera, right, and the other case that we're talking about is Georgia,
right,
which I know is perceived as a strong case and has had a lot of challenges just maybe in terms of public perception because of the whole imbroglio with Fannie Willis. How does this stand up to that? Obviously, Trump is not in this one in the same way, but how would you compare the cases?
I think this is a laser and not a kitchen sink. Mm-hmm.
And that one's much broader.
That one's sprawling. That one includes like pressure being placed on election officials and trying to get them to change.
The racketeering aspect of this?
Absolutely. The racketeering and racketeering law in Georgia is even broader than federal racketeering law, which in its own terms is very broad. So there's so many aspects to the Georgia one, and it's also got many more defendants operating at the national and state level. The fact that it included Donald Trump also did gum up the works in litigation to some extent, because then he's able to make arguments like presidential immunity or supremacy clause type claims that are special to the president. And so that's why that case is a very difficult case to move forward. This case is built for speed and is, I agree, laser focused.
But having said that, Aaron, mm-hmm. I think there is something to be said for charging the racketeering, which was charged in Georgia. If there's an enterprise and that enterprise is significant with respect to its goal and purpose to commit criminality, that's the right call. And as a prosecutor, I think you have to be committed to the notion of justice, right? Some do it more efficiently.
So they could have gone much bigger on this, clearly.
Given the facts.
Could have charged the former president. They chose not to.
Absolutely, right. For whatever their discretionary reasons as a prosecutor they have, some do things differently. The end result will be what it'll be. Everyone's presumed innocent till proven guilty. But I think the racketeering nature of the Georgia case, whether you agree or disagree, I think was the right call based on their theory in Georgia.
All right. As we just bring Jeff Zeleny into this conversation, obviously he's been covering this from the beginning. And Jeff Zeleny, what have you been learning here as we just go through this 58-page indictment coming out of the state of Arizona?
Well, Aaron, one thing is clear. Arizona, like Georgia, another key battleground state. I mean, Joe Biden only won Arizona by about 10,000 votes. So Arizona has always going to be ground zero of this reelection. Certainly the abortion measure by the Supreme Court has added to that. And now this,
yes,
latest round of indictments will add to it as well. Both campaigns are assessing this, talking to someone in the Biden campaign just a few moments ago, really reading this page of indictments as well, whereas the Trump campaign also assessing this. So the reality is we do not know the political fallout or impact from any of these cases, just like the case in New York or Georgia. We do not know if this will enhance former President Donald Trump or will impede him politically. These are operating on two very different tracks. We've seen him enhanced over the last year, Donald Trump, by these criminal charges. Some of his supporters believe people are piling on, if you will, these various prosecutors. But as the information comes in from all these separate indictments, this is definitely something the Trump campaign obviously does not welcome or want, something Republicans do not welcome or want. So as we sort of digest this, keep in mind Arizona is so important to the pieces of the puzzle here that go into the battleground states. And this new piece of evidence always reminds us we don't know what elections are going to be about. This is a dynamic process for 6 months to come. So
right,
this certainly impacts it as well.
And we certainly don't know. I mean, everyone points to polls of what people say they will do or how they will react in a conviction. And
right,
you know what? I mean, I know we talk about polls. They're all we've got. But I don't think we have any idea until something actually happens and you see what people think. Ty, I know you were going through what you thought maybe the distinction between who is actually charged and who's an unindicted co-conspirator. But what do you think? I mean, obviously, you can't get in the head of
sure,
the decision to charge here, but they could have obviously charged Donald J. Trump in this.
Right.
He's front and center in all of it. I mean, even just going through it now as quickly as I can, unindicted co-conspirator number one, it's right, left and center all the way through this. What do you think the thinking may have been as to why not to charge him here when there certainly was a precedent to do so in Georgia?
Sure. I think Joey's right. I mean, in the sense of pointing out that prosecutors have a great deal of discretion. And if you look at this, you know, through the prosecutorial lens, Donald Trump's indicted twice federally, once, you know, in connection with this whole scheme, and that he has benefited from the, you know, playing the martyr. And as the cases pile up, I think there's, you know, I think I can see a prosecutor's thinking, you know, there's really no reason for us to do this. It's being done. You know, we owe the taxpayers, you know, some loyalty too. And, you know, why take on that burden? At the same time, sure, they could have. But I don't think it's necessary, particularly when you've already got this serious federal indictment and you've got the indictment in Georgia. So I can see why they would have done it. Also, I think it makes the case a little bit easier for them. And, you know, I think they will be, you know, focused largely on people in the state and people who have, you know, have had actual interactions with those fake electors.
So this 58-page document comes out right now, and we are hours away from the Supreme Court hearing the immunity case on whether Donald Trump is immune from actions that he did while president of the United States, as he says that he is, so that he says he can't be charged in Mar-a-Lago, can't be charged in January 6th. What could that ruling mean for cases like this in Arizona and cases in Georgia?
That's a great question. I mean, I do think that in a certain sense, theoretically, if the president is immune from federal prosecution for all acts while in office, then, as we say in the law, a fortiori, even more so, he is immune or she would be immune for prosecution by state and local officials.
Even more so.
Yeah, because if there's federal immunity for something like that because of federal law, then he would be even more protected against state and local prosecutors in trying to intrude on the president's powers. That would be anathema in that vision of the world, but that vision is going to die tomorrow before the Supreme Court. The absolutist idea that the Trump lawyers are putting forward will not survive Supreme Court scrutiny. They will find that he does not have that kind of immunity. A person who's in the office can commit crimes, and that's been the understanding. There was a draft indictment for Nixon. Independent investigator for Clinton was thinking of indicting him. That's just the general understanding. So I think you could imagine a world in which the state prosecutors in Arizona say, wait, let's wait to see how the Supreme Court goes, and then we can move forward.
All right. I'll stay with me. Let's go back to Zach Cohen. I know, Zach, you've got some more breaking details here. What have you just learned?
Yeah, Aaron, look at this indictment. It looks like there's 9 counts total, and including multiple felonies. And one of those felonies is conspiracy. And again, that goes back to what we were talking about earlier about how this investigation really did seem to initially be just focused on the electors. We've seen in Michigan, for example, just the electors were charged there. But the conspiracy count does underscore how this investigation did expand, did widen to include some of those people in Trump's inner orbit, some of those people that were working on his national campaign to put these fake electors forward, to have them sign those fraudulent documents. It's really more reminiscent of the indictment we saw in Georgia, the RICO charge in Georgia, than it is of some of the other fake elector charges we've seen. Also really interesting, as you mentioned previously, that Donald Trump is an unindicted co-conspirator in this case. We learned today as well that he's an unindicted co-conspirator in Michigan. So he's now being named in 2 different criminal investigations at the state level. We know he's charged in Georgia, making that a 3rd case. So really interesting that he is included in this charging document, albeit as an unindicted co-conspirator. And I want to look at Boris Epstein as being indicted in this case, too, because Boris Epstein is somebody who, like I said, has remained really close to the former president. He was there in court in Manhattan back when Donald Trump was arraigned in the New York hush money case. But we're told by sources, Kristen Holmes, our great colleague, is told that the reason Boris Epstein has been kept at a distance recently from Donald Trump is because of concerns that this indictment was coming. They thought that he was going to be implicated in that indictment, and we know now that he was. So a lot of big bold-faced names in this indictment, including one that we're identifying now is Christina Bob, the former OAN anchor. She's somebody who we've previously reported was working with Rudy Giuliani to help organize these fake electors in multiple states, including Arizona. She's on multiple planning calls with different representatives from the Trump campaign from these various states, too. So really a bigger swing than maybe we were expecting at first. But Arizona, with that conspiracy charge, those multiple felonies, some potentially pretty serious consequences.
Ty, interesting. The point is, he said, took a bigger swing than some might have expected. You have Christina Bob, who is an anchor for the far right network, on there as well.
Yes. Yeah, so I think that's true. And I think in both Michigan and Arizona, she's an unindicted co-conspirator, I believe. And again, that goes to my point of, you know, I can see them fashioning this in a way that tries to scope in all the people who actually, you know, contacted fake electors, organized fake electors, you know, helped policy-wise in terms of how they were going to do this, which would include Epstein. So I think that's that seems to be the distinction that they used in identifying the people that they were going to mention in the indictment, either as unindicted co-conspirators or actual defendants. I do think that Epstein is fascinating as a defendant in this case. As you know from your conversations with Tim Parlatore and Jim Trusty, they're not going to lose any sleep over Boris's fate tonight.
But he's been with Trump a lot. I mean, remember when he was on the plane going down for the Mar-a-Lago indictment appearances? I mean, he's of all these people still so in his inner circle.
Right. We're very much in his inner circle and very protective of the former president and protective to the point that Giuliani reached when, you know, he, you know, arguably sold his soul to protect the president and under circumstances that were improper.
All right, all stay with me. I do want to bring in Rusty Bauer, central to this entire indictment. Rusty is the former Republican Speaker of the House of Representatives in Arizona. Famously, Rusty, you testified before the January 6th committee about how Trump and Giuliani pressured you to overturn the 2020 election results in Arizona. I know you and I have had a chance to speak many times, but now here we are. Rusty, we've got a 58-page indictment in your state. What's your reaction from what you know so far?
Well, from what I know is what you just told me. if that's the case, then I'm a witness, and I hesitate in talking about it to any length other than what I publicly have said previously.
Rusty, I am, you know, literally, we are breaking this on the air, so I will admit here, I'm reading as we're covering it. But I'm just looking at page 31 is one of the places where you are introduced. Here's how they introduced you. They say, Russell Rusty Bauer served in the Arizona legislature from 2015 to the beginning of 2023. They lay out who you are. And then they talk about the extensive pressure that you spoke about being under to overturn the election in the state house, that you said you were getting hundreds of emails demanding that I do my constitutional duty and name electors that will vote for Trump. That you then said you were, quote, getting very strange and unsettling phone calls telling me to do my duty and vote to electors who will vote for Trump. Rusty, how intense was this pressure?
Well, there was pressure, and it was intense, and it was, you know, it's now going on almost 3 years, but it was intense, you know. But for some, that might have been real troubling. You know, I don't know how I feel about it now, but at the time, it was certainly demanding of my staff, my assistants. They had to put up with thousands, not hundreds, thousands of emails and calls. So they're troopers. Can you hear me?
Yes. Oh, I can hear you, Rusty. I know you're on the phone and we're dealing with that connection, but I got you loud and clear. We're just going through here. You know, a lot of these names, Rusty, are redacted because they're still in the process of serving some of the individuals being charged. So you have the false elector slate in your state of Arizona. And you also have others who are close to Trump and were very much a part of this. Rudy Giuliani, Mark Meadows, Boris Epstein. Do any of those, Christina Bobb, a news anchor for the far-right network, OANN, I believe, do any of those names surprise you, Rusty?
No, it doesn't surprise me, no, not at all. I mean, I did get calls from some of them, not Bob. I never talked to her, but others, yes. And some of those people were famously in our state involved and did videos of themselves and other things, but...
So, Rusty,
It's sad to see it come to this. I better not comment other than say, yeah, they did call me.
They did. Well, the other person in here, unindicted co-conspirator number one, I just want to read you how he's described. Unindicted co-conspirator number one, Rusty, on page 21, a former president of the United States who spread false claims of election fraud following the 2020 election. Rusty, are you surprised that Donald Trump is unindicted as a co-conspirator?
Well, I'm not the prosecutor. I'm not an advocate. I'm just a witness. I only talk about things that happened to me.
Right.
And I can, you know, I could.
I mean, from your perspective as a witness, does that surprise you? I mean, you lived this in a way that everyone watching didn't, right? You know more than anybody else, probably more than anybody else, what actually happened. So does it surprise you, given what you dealt with, that he is not indicted?
I do remember the phone call. I do remember his involvement. I do remember how he couched his speech and his terms. And in some ways, I'm not surprised. I'm not surprised in the Arizona case, as far as I'm concerned. I mean, the fact that he was the president and called me, yeah, that's impressive. But all that testimony is going to have to come out in court. And it looks like if they've indicted him, it looks like I'm going to be involved. And I better not give my feelings about it too deeply.
All right. Well, Rusty.
And I hope you'll understand that.
No, I do understand that. I do want to be clear that he is unindicted co-conspirator number one. Rusty, thank you so much for taking the time and being with us.
Thank you so much for the call.
All right. Good to talk to you, Rusty. We're going to take a break. We're going to be back. I had a conversation with the Speaker of the House, Mike Johnson, today about the campus protests raging around the country. His decision to leave Washington and come make a call for a major resignation at Columbia University. His message to America tonight next.
The assignment with me, Audie Cornish.
So there have been arrests, suspensions, disciplinary hearings. They're shutting down graduation events.
At this moment, the part of the protests that are admirable are young people calling attention to atrocities.
Michael Roth is the president of Wesleyan University.
I would like to make a space for them to do that, as long as that space doesn't prevent other people from pursuing their education.
Listen to The Assignment with me, Audie Cornish, on your favorite podcast app.
Breaking news, there are pro-Palestinian protests across the United States spreading violent clashes today between police and students at USC and UT Austin, where more than 20 people were arrested. This follows protests at NYU, Brown University, and Columbia University, where an encampment has taken over part of the center of campus. More than 100 have been arrested. In-person classes have been canceled after 8 straight days of demonstrations. I was on that campus earlier today to interview the House Speaker Mike Johnson. This is what I saw and heard. Johnson walked out. There were hundreds of people on the steps where he and other GOP representatives that he had brought along with him and his entourage spoke. They were, and I'm going to show you here, this is my cell phone video, chanting Free Palestine, heckling, booing when Johnson called for the president of the school to resign. They were not friendly. They couldn't actually hear the speaker, which I can tell you is a good thing, because much of what he said would have incensed that crowd. And after the press conference, the speaker's team moved us inside into the Columbia Library, where the speaker did interviews. They put that entire space under lockdown because of that large crowd. So here's our conversation right after that, hundreds of people outside when we moved, rushed inside the library, moments after that tense press conference. Speaker Johnson, you know, thanks for your time. Obviously, there's a lot going on in Congress right now. You've chosen to travel to New York, and as you were just out on those steps calling for the resignation of the president of here of Columbia, there was heckling, there was shouting, that was not a warm reception.
Enjoy your free speech.
Were you surprised at all by what happened?
Well, there was a sea of students who apparently have been involved in the protest here, and I'm not surprised that they didn't welcome our visit because we're calling out their activities. The point we tried to make today is that this is not who we are as Americans. This is not an expression of the First Amendment. This is not an exchange of ideas. This is threats and intimidation of violence against Jewish students for who they are, for their faith. And that's a terrible trend that's going on in the country right now. We have these similar types of activities and what are becoming violent protests on campuses around the country. And members of Congress, I believe, have an obligation, a responsibility to speak about this and to demand that it come to an end, because it's not good for us.
The main thing they were chanting was Free Palestine. How is that anti-Semitic?
Well, what's anti-Semitic is that Hamas endorsed this protest today. Within the last 2 hours, they issued an endorsement statement and heralded the students here and said, this is the next generation of leadership in America. If you're getting endorsed by Hamas, that's not a good look. It's not a good sign. Some of these students apparently are unaware of the atrocities of October 7th, or they're denying it. They deny that women and children were brutally raped and murdered, that infants were placed into ovens and cooked alive. The things that happened there are unspeakable, and yet they're out there waving flags for the very people who committed those atrocities. This is not who we are.
Speaker, in those early days, I was in some of the kibbutz, and you could smell the death.
and the bodies. It was horrific. And yet what's happened since has been horrific too. And there's a student here, a PhD student at Columbia. I wanted to quote him. He is Jewish. He has written a testimonial about what's going on here right now, his experience on campus. And he says, I'll read it to you, the most pressing threats to our safety as Jewish students do not come from tents on campus. We should be focusing on the material reality of war, the munitions our government is sending to Israel, which kill Palestinians by the thousands, and the Americans participating in the violence. Do you think that protesting the humanitarian catastrophe in Gaza, protesting the tens of thousands of innocent people who have died there, is anti-Semitic in and of itself?
I think there's always a place for debate in the free exchange of ideas, but let's not equivocate on what's happening in Hamas, with Hamas and in Gaza. This is a battle, as Netanyahu said, Prime Minister Netanyahu said, between good versus evil, light versus darkness, civilization versus barbarism. This isn't a close call. We have terrorists who preyed upon and attacked viciously and killed many innocent Israelis. And the idea that they would be out here in support of that, Hamas is using civilians as shields for themselves. They put their operations under hospitals and schools. They're using civilians in a theater of war. And so it's difficult. Why would someone blame Israel for trying to stamp out the very terrorist threats that are right there on the doorstep? We should not be dictating to Israel their military strategy. We should be supporting our ally, which is the only stable democracy
in the Middle East. Is there anything Israel could do that would be over the line for you? Because when you talk about stamping it out, I mean, many innocent children have died and are dying at Israel's hands and the IDF.
There have been civilians murdered, but that is not the fault of Israel. It's the fault of the terrorists, the Hamas operators and soldiers, the terrorists who have used these people and put them into harm's way. Israel, I'm convinced, is doing its very best to prevent civilian casualties, but this is a war, and they're fighting for their very existence, and they are not the aggressors. It is the other side. Some of the people here seem not to understand that, and I think that's a real problem. We can debate the merits of all these things, but what they're doing here is intimidating Jewish students. That's the thing that is so problematic.
All right, so let me ask you about that, because when it comes to that, the NYPD, at least as of Monday, have said they've not received a single call from Columbia University of reports of any physical harm.
Well,
no physical harm.
Right, but you have to speak to these Jewish students who are in fear of their lives, who are cowering in their apartments right now, who are not coming to class. In fact, the administration recognized the threat was so great, they canceled classes. Now they've come out with this hybrid idea. Well, if you're Jewish, maybe you do want to stay at home. Maybe it'd be better off for you. It is so discriminatory. It's so wrong in every way. The responsibility of a university administrator is to keep peace on campus and ensure the safety of students. Job number one. If they're incapable of doing that, then you need different leadership. I think this is time for a really strong hand.
I'm trying to understand, though, why as Speaker of the House, this is an issue you would want to get involved with. It's a private university. It's an issue happening here. Why is this something that you are choosing to get involved in calling for the removal of a president of a private university?
Well, they receive federal funding as well. And Congress is looking at all of these aspects to determine how they're using those funds. Is that appropriate? If they can't fulfill their basic obligations, I don't think the American taxpayers want to be funding this kind of thing. We know that professors are engaging in this as well, some of the professors. Some have been supportive of the Jewish students, but I believe it's a small subset from what I've told. They've allowed this to go on, and it is not okay with the American people. This isn't a partisan issue. This is about right and wrong, and we've got to call it for what it is.
And so when people talk about genocide and say that Israel is engaging in genocide, do you think that that is a legitimate conversation that they should be allowed to have as part of First Amendment rights here? Or
well,
no?
Of course. Look, I was a First Amendment lawyer for 20 years. I went into the courts and defended our First Amendment freedoms, religious expression, the right of free speech on campus. I litigated those cases. Of course, the university is supposed to be the free marketplace of ideas. But when you shout down and physically threaten with intimidation and threats of violence the other side, that is not a peaceful expression, a peaceful exchange of ideas. That's something very different, and that's what we're saying they need to get control of. When they camp out around the campus and they prevent students from exercising their rights, mm-hmm. That's the problem.
Before you go, obviously we're here in New York as there's been threats to your speakership back in Washington. What does it say about your standing as speaker that you are here at Columbia University dealing with this issue right now?
The Speaker of the House has a very important constitutional responsibility. It's an officer listed in the Constitution. The Speaker speaks for the House of Representatives, and I felt it was very important for that voice to be heard, not just about what happens at Columbia, but about what is happening right now around the country. And we have to stand unequivocally for the right and the good, and I'm calling on all my colleagues on both sides of the aisle to speak out against this. Not to endorse it, not to coddle these people, but to say this has to stop. We have to treat every single person with dignity and respect, and that's not happening here, and it's an atrocity.
Speaker Johnson, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
I conducted that interview just about a couple hours ago. Thanks so much for joining us. We hope you stay here with CNN. AC 360 begins right now.
When you work next level. When you play next level. And when it's time to sleep, Sleep Number smart beds are designed to embrace your uniqueness, providing you with high-quality sleep every night. Sleep next level. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, the Queen Sleep Number C4 smart bed is only $1,599. Save $300 for a limited time, only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com. Prices higher in Alaska and Hawaii. Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number smart bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.